What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Fitness Stuff for Normal People podcast. I'm Tony.
And I'm Mariana.
And let's be real. The fitness industry right now, it kind of sucks. It's become something that is entirely based on doing whatever you can to drive page views or clicks. Really just directing attention away from the things that actually matter. So no, we're not just trying to provide you with another fitness podcast, but actually give you the knowledge and tools so you have the confidence to apply the best possible training and nutrition into your own life. Where today we are talking about the five most misunderstood topics in health and fitness, from seed oils to sugar and insulin to cortisol and fat burning. These are some of the most talked about and heavily debated subjects across modern media that most people don't even know how they work in the first place. Today, we're going to actually break down each one, reviewing the actual data and research on these topics to provide you with a clear picture on how these different aspects function and to what degree they impact your health. Hopefully, by the end of this episode, you'll know exactly how much attention or possible worry you need to be giving to each one. And as always, the easiest and freest way you listening can support this show is to take the next 15 seconds and go leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. And if you're on Spotify, you can even hit that little follow button in the upper left corner. So every single Monday when we publish a new episode, it pops right up on your homepage so you don't miss a thing.
And if you want more after each episode, you can join us on Premium for just $5 a month, where you get access to all of our complete 12-week training programs. You also get a bonus episode every single Friday where we answer your questions and other great perks. You can go ahead and sign up in the show notes. Hello. And as always, a quick shout out to today's sponsor, Legion Athletics. We've partnered with them since day one. How they approach the supplement industry is really something we align with and believe in and really respect. And their products are wonderful, especially their protein powder. Their whey protein isolate is also lactose free, which I always recommend to people who really struggle to digest protein powders or have finally upset their stomach, because that's the most readily absorbed and digested by the body. If you want to try out any of their products, you can use the code FSPOD at checkout for 20% off your first order and double points on every order after that. We will leave the link in the show notes below.
Today's EP.
Let's go.
Let's go. So it makes a little bit more sense. There we go.
I think that's my favorite sound of the day. It's my favorite noise of the day. Cracking open a diet
coke. I think we should make it part of our just intro sound. Not even you doing it, just part of your...
What's that song, that Justin Bieber song that they literally are... Someone's in the background cracking open a...
There's a Bieber song?
Oh, I forget.
It's an oddly fulfilling sound.
You need to get one, though. Like, we need to be matching.
I get my groceries on Amazon Fresh. Amazon Fresh. Mm-hmm. And I think someone had a typo, because a 12-pack of caffeine-free Diet Coke, usually it's like 10, 11 bucks for a 12-pack. It was like 90% off. It's $1.95 for a 12-pack of these. So I just added as many to my cart as I possibly could. So now I just have 7 12-packs of caffeine-free Diet Coke sitting
up. That's hilarious.
And I'm like, okay, I'm good for the next year. But I'll start bringing those into the episode. Now, why have we not talked about this yet? What we're talking about today.
I feel like we've mentioned all of these to a degree, but I feel like there's so many topics that we're always like, oh, we need to deep dive on these, and we just never do. So honestly, I feel like this has been a long time coming.
We're big talkers and we're trying to be big doers. That's what we're trying
to do. Well, we do have a podcast, so we talk a lot.
We're yappers.
I'm a yap. I'm gonna yap.
We have a lot of topics that we're gonna talk about today, and I feel like the most misunderstood topics in fitness and health, I was trying to get to the bottom of how and where they all tend to start and see if I could notice any patterns. And I feel like a lot of these start and go in a very similar way. And I'm curious if you see this too, where I feel like most people who arrive at these very polarizing positions always start out with a factual mechanism in the body, like factual, something that inside the body is factual. It happens. It's true. But then based on that, they or someone else will make an assumption and put it on top of that. And then another assumption, and then another assumption, until you are so far away from that original factual mechanism. But in your brain, you're right next to it. It's just as factual. I feel like it's so many assumptions that get just put on top of one another until you are so far away from the truth or anything that is remotely real. Do you notice that too? I feel like that's with everything that we're going to talk about today and every big misunderstanding in fitness. That's what it is.
This is a fundamental issue when it comes to interpreting anything about your health that I found, we would talk about this all the time in grad school especially, is what goes on in your body and things that actually take place in your body and how your body can be influenced by other factors, what have you. But things that are absolutely taking place, you can't question it, things that can happen in your body, how that is applied, how people use that to apply it in the real world and use what's actually going on to almost oversimplify it, make it sound super simple. And just because like it happens in your body, it means that you can manipulate it. I think that's the word I was looking for. Mm. You can manipulate it very easily, whether that's through diet, whether that's through exercise. You have this huge power to increase or decrease a process or improve a process or, I don't know, make it go faster, whatever, what have you. It's this oversimplification in terms of how we apply it in the real world that I think is really just goes over people's heads.
I think you're right. And it just goes, it's like a game of telephone where it just slowly changes and changes and changes until it's so far from what's actually going on. So what we want to do today, and I think all five of these have been, if not some of the most trending, at least very heavily talked about subjects in health and fitness for the last 5 to 10 years, where people are saying these words, talking about it. And I think one of the bigger problems is people can't even define the words that they're talking about. They can't even define half of these things that we're going to do. So that's our goal today, is to break these down, to define what they are, like what we're even talking about. And then seeing, I guess, how much we really need to be worrying about certain things and these most of these aspects of our health. So let's start off the day with one that's been, I would argue, the biggest on this list for the longest time, which is sugar. The conversation of sugar. Mm-hmm. Is this, do you think, the biggest on the list for the last decade? Seed oils is big lately, but I feel like sugar is, over the last decade, got to be number one. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I would say that and burning fat to a degree.
I can see that too. I could see an argument
for
that.
How they are used changes over time, but it's kind of all the same shit. It's like how they're spoken about has changed, but it all comes down to the same thing at the end of the day.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to sugar, there's been, and I think most people just believe this without really questioning it, that sugar is bad, with how many times the messages have just been drilled into our brain, that sugar is as addictive as cocaine, that it's actually at the root of every disease we know today. It even feeds cancer cells. It feeds tumors. This is something that is commonly talked about. Or you cannot eat sugar if you have any hopes of getting fit or athletic or improving your health. Sugar is the number one thing. I think if you ask the next 100 people, if I go outside on my street and ask the next 100 people, they would all say, yeah, sugar's terrible for you. Sugar is inherently terrible for you. And I think it's important to ask why people think this, because there's a reason. I promise there's a reason for any person thinking a certain way. They think it for a reason. I think most people are sane human beings. I think most people are honestly smarter than others give them credit for. And if someone believes in something, there's a reason why they must believe it, right? Like a person who's afraid of dogs, they probably have a semi-understandable reason for why they're afraid of dogs. Maybe they were bitten as a little kid. Something else was happening. You know what I'm saying? If someone's afraid of dogs, they have at least what can be heard as a semi-understandable reason to them for why they're afraid of dogs, right?
Yeah, I think there's a camp of people who genuinely have had this experience with say sugar or in their lives over time. Maybe it's been traumatic. I don't know. But I also think that there are people who want to believe what they want to believe when it comes to certain topics, especially in nutrition. Some people can just get their mind on something and there might not be a rhyme or reason or an experience, but it's just something that they really want to align themselves with or define themselves by in terms of nutrition. Mm.
Because I think there's always some reason. It might not be a good reason, but there's always a reason. And I think for the most people who really do fear sugar and think it's this terrible, terrible thing. And I'm also, right now, I'm not saying it's the greatest thing in the world. I haven't even gotten to where I stand on this yet. But I feel like for most people, the reason why they think sugar is so bad is either one of three things. Like maybe one, they just hear others saying that sugar is bad. And obviously, people are busy. Their lives aren't fitness. They should not have to pay this much attention to nutrition and health sciences. They've got kids and a job. It's not their job. So if you hear a million people around you saying one thing, you kind of just believe it. And you're like, okay, I'll believe it for now until I see otherwise. Maybe two, you could just be looking around and you might notice that the people who are always eating these snacks that you think are high in sugar, candies, treats, desserts, typically aren't the healthiest people, maybe more on the overweight, obese side. And you just see those two things correlate a little bit. Or maybe honestly, a lot of people are now less healthy than they used to be. And they look around and people are like, hey, have you ever looked at how much sugar you're taking in? And they say, oh, dang, I actually have quite a bit of sugar in my house. That must be the problem, right? That's the reason I'm fatter, I'm more out of shape, I'm whatever, is because of the sugar. So it's believable in a sense if you don't spend too much time thinking about it. But I think this is the biggest problem is what I was mentioning up front is most people who are very afraid of sugar or think it's terrible, or honestly, most of the people I see talking about it online can't even define what it is. If you say, do me a favor, like just so we're on the same talking grounds, define what sugar is so I know what we're talking about. Most people I don't think could define that for you, and that's a problem. But just with how communication and how important that is, if you're talking about words that you don't even know the definition to, what are you really saying? There's 100% chance you're going to mislead people if you don't know the words you're talking about. I think it's important to start there with what is sugar? What is sugar? One of the most misunderstood bros. We're trying to represent a little bit.
What types of sugar? Oh my goodness. Crazy. It's sugar.
So at a basic level, and we're not going to go deep into the trenches and make this a sugar science episode, but to give you guys a brief understanding, sugars are just a form of carbohydrate, right? Sugars are a form of carbohydrates. And their primary role in the body is energetic, meaning the body uses them to produce energy at a cellular level, right? That is their primary role in the body. And there are three forms of sugar, either monosaccharides, oligosaccharides, or polysaccharides. Now, monosaccharides, these are what most people point to as sugar. These are like the more simple sugars. They have a very simple structure. But even for monosaccharides, there's three different kinds. There's glucose, fructose, and galactose that primarily make up those. Glucose is like if you're measuring your blood sugar, that's what's in your blood, what your body is using as fuel. Okay, this is also contained in most foods in a chemical form. There's also fructose, which is naturally found in most fruit and a lot of processed products like table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and galactose, which is a sugar found in dairy, right? But at the end of the day, all three of those are processed down and metabolized down to glucose. They're all broken down into glucose in your bloodstream. When it comes to oligosaccharides, we're not going to talk too long about these, but these are more molecules that are linked together in a chain-like structure that are the components of fiber found in plants. These are the ones that our bodies are able to partially break down into glucose, but leave parts behind, right? A lot of these are more complex carbs is how people refer to them. And then there's polysaccharides, which are just long chains of monosaccharides, like wheat, rice, oats, barley, which again, at the end of the day, get broken down into that same structure, glucose. Now, if you haven't noticed a pattern so far, I'll point it out to you. All of these different forms get broken down into glucose. All of these different forms get broken down into glucose. All forms of carbs we eat are either metabolized into glucose or are left indigested as dietary fiber. Those are the two options you got when you take in any sort of carb, broken down into the simplest form of sugar or left undigested as dietary fiber. Now, our bodies, and I'm going to have to clarify this after this, our bodies can't distinguish between the natural sugar found in fruit, honey, or milk, or the processed sugar found in Skittles when it gets broken down to that final structure. Okay, they all get broken down into monosaccharides, which are all turned into glucose, which is either used as energy or stored in your muscle tissue or liver for later use. Side note, but that's right. Next to none of the carbs or sugar you eat can possibly be stored as fat. It's not how that works. People don't like to tell you that part. But most carbs and sugars cannot be physically stored as body fat. The only difference between all of these is that the simple carbs or the simpler carbs get converted into that glucose quicker. And that's really the main difference between the two, or all forms, is what I would say. Is that a good simple explanation of it?
Yeah, you're asking me. I think so. And this is a topic that is, I find, you know, as someone who did my degree in nutritional biochemistry, this is so much more complex, but all of the main points you pulled out, I think were perfect without confusing people too much. And I like how you highlighted how our body can't recognize whether it's sugar from Skittles or if it's sugar from fruit after it's broken down. And that piece is where you see so much misinterpretation, mm-hmm. and people refuse to believe that fact. But that is absolutely true. What the difference comes down to is the nutrients profile found in those foods. Obviously, Skittles are not a health food. No one's going to say that. You're going to see a lot more nutrients in vegetables containing carbohydrates that are sugars, but how they're digested and absorb those sugars, no fucking difference.
And we are not saying that Skittles are the same things as a banana. That is not what we're saying. And here's where I think
people will take it as that.
That's where I needed to say that, because I feel like a lot of these misunderstanding topics are because when people try to have productive conversations about them, and we still have a lot to go because this probably came far from answering any of your questions about, but a lot of the conversations that are trying to be productive about these misunderstood topics, people shut down and they do not listen because they disagree with a point that the other person didn't even really say. Right. Mm-hmm. And none of that did I say that Skittles are the same things as eating bananas. But people will still hear that and say, oh, this guy's just saying to eat candy all day. It doesn't matter what you eat. It doesn't matter if you eat fruits and vegetables. It doesn't matter. Who cares? That's not what's being said at all. I'm just saying that the sucrose found in pineapples is no chemically different than the sucrose found in your favorite dessert. And I think we want to break up a couple of these claims. And the first set of research that we want to look at is sugar and its link to obesity. And is sugar inherently more fattening or can lead to obesity more than any other nutrient alone? And good news for us, there's been a lot of data on this. And I hope this wouldn't come to a shock to anybody listening to this show, but it might. When you look at all the data, it turns out that sugars do not, this is absolute, do not make you fat. Overeating calories makes you fat. In every paper done. But there is a few reasons why people think sugar is inherently more fattening than other foods. And this is why, so we can explain that. Now, the first problem, I think, with people labeling certain foods as sugary foods is that a lot of the time, these foods aren't even primarily sugary foods. They'll label things like donuts or milkshakes or things like that as sugary foods, when they have some sugar in them, but they have a lot of saturated fat. They have a lot of sodium. They have a lot of other things that aren't just sugar, right? Table sugar is the purest form of sugar you could find out there with no other nutrients. That's what we could be talking about. Like when someone's drinking a chocolate milkshake from Chick-fil-A, or your host here, Tony, that was his first job, was at Chick-fil-A. You can ask if he asked nicely to put the cookies and cream mix in with the chocolate milkshake to get a cookies and cream chocolate milkshake. So good. Anywho, if you do that at Chick-fil-A, or you get, let's say, a pink sprinkled donut, people will call that a sugary food and say that's why it's bad for you, is the sugar in all that food. Which, don't get me wrong, again, these are all packed with sugar, but they're also packed with so much more. Like, it might have 20 grams of sugar, but what about that 30 grams of fat that it contains? Or the fact that it's 400 calories in a single donut? Okay, I'm not saying that donuts are inherently good or bad either. I'm just highlighting that most foods aren't just one nutrient. And I see this a lot when it comes to demonizing sugar. Is the foods people will demonize for being sugary aren't just sugar foods. There are a lot of other foods. The second piece is that sugar can be easy to consume a lot of. Like if you drink a cup of orange juice that's high in sugar, you can drink 200 calories before your meal and it won't make you any less hungry than if you didn't have it. You'll eat just as much for breakfast if you didn't have that orange juice beforehand. Okay, this makes it really, really easy to overconsume total calories. And I think this quote from this study conducted by researchers at the University of Hawaii, who did an extensive review of sugar-related literature when looking at USDA to make actual guideline purposes. And after reviewing all relevant data, they said, it is important to state at the outset that there is no direct connection between added sugar intake and obesity. Let me repeat this. There is no direct connection between added sugar intake and obesity unless excessive consumption of sugar-containing beverages and foods leads to energy imbalance and the result of weight gain. This is just saying, unless that sugar intake leads you to eat an excess of calories, it's not sugar's fault that you're gaining the weight. And when you look at the data and the research on humans, it is clear that sugars and carbs do not influence fat loss when total calories are matched. For example, and I pulled together a lot of different papers that we can actually link down below. Duke University, this is a great one, found no difference in weight or fat loss between people consuming either 4 or almost 50% of their total calories from sugar over 6 weeks. Two groups. One contained almost 50% of their total calories from sugar. The other 4%, next to none, for 6 weeks. And they saw the exact same weight loss, the exact same fat loss over that 6 week period. Same thing at Queen Margaret University, between 5 and 10%. And it's been repeated over and over again. And this is just a side note as well, but before we go to the next piece, all of those studies that also tested for blood work showed that there was no difference in high versus low sugar groups in improvements in metabolic panels, like their fasted glucose, their fasted insulin, their HbA1c, all saw similar improvements.
Yeah. I feel like this is just like important to note for this entire episode. There is one physiological way to gain weight, and that's when your calorie intake is going to exceed your overall energy expenditure. That is not going to change. That is going to be the same from person to person. There's one way for that to happen in the body. The road to get there, how you get there, is going to change from person to person. Maybe someone eat a lot of ultra processed, high sugar foods that made them eat in a calorie surplus over time. And this has to be over time. It's not just like one day or like, no, this is over time you're eating in a calorie surplus. The road's going to look different, but people like to point blame so that it's easier than facing what's actually going on and what's actually leading you to eat in excess of calories.
Yeah. And the last two pieces, which this one is, because I know people are going to say, okay, weight loss, weight gain, that's not the only thing that matters. When you eat sugar, you're going to spike your insulin, and that will lead to poor health. And we're going to talk about this a lot more in the insulin part of today's episode, because insulin is its own misunderstood topic, which I think we'll leave there just because I don't want to drag the sugar piece out too long. But the funniest piece to me is like the same people who are eating like oatmeal, sweet potatoes, again, phenomenal foods, super nutrient dense foods, but they're like almost saying, yeah, bro, like I'm controlling my insulin. I would never touch sugar. And then look at fructose, one of the most commonly found sugars. Like you eat an orange and it has a lower GI index, or it spikes your blood sugar less than the foods that they're eating. Oatmeal will spike your insulin greater than eating fructose from an orange will. Sugar isn't inherently what spikes your insulin, which isn't really a problem at the end. And the crazy part is, and here's the part that, trust me, I looked long and hard to disprove this line of thought, and I could not do it. When you control for body composition, and when people aren't over consuming total calories and are hitting their minimum protein, fat, and daily movement requirements, there has not been a single link of sugar to any negative health outcome, period. When all of those things are controlled, there's never been an isolated piece of data ever that links sugar, when those things are controlled for, to a negative health outcome. And that's what I trust me, I tried to look long and hard to find something that contradicts this, and I could not find one. And I know people are probably, oh my God, how are you saying the sugars? Look yourself. When composition and body composition is controlled for, when people aren't over consuming calories, overweight, or obese, and when people are hitting their minimum protein, fat, and daily movement requirements, show me any piece of data that shows you that any amount of sugar, when those are met, has a negative health outcome. I promise you're going to be looking for a long time. Yeah. And the last piece before we move into our next one, which is cortisol, this thought that drives me crazy, which is a lot of people, have you heard this claim that sugar feeds cancer? That's very commonly heard. Like, doesn't sugar feed cancer? Now, unfortunately, for people that believe that, sugar only feeds cancer if you're basing all of your knowledge on outdated cancer biology from the 1920s. That's over 100 years ago, for those wondering. If it were really that simple, I don't think this is the part that I'm like, think about this for a minute. If it was really that simple, that if you could just cut cancer off from sugar and it would stop growing because that's what feeds it, then 10 million plus people would not be dying every year from cancer.
No.
Okay? Because you could just stop eating sugar and poof, it's gone. Okay? Because based on all science from the 21st century, all cancer research since the 1980s moving forward has shown that cancer metabolism is not as simple as just sugar feeds cancer, shockingly. Okay? It's kind of a half-truth as well, because all cells in your body feed on sugar. And even your healthiest cells rely so heavily on sugar to survive that it will convert other compounds like proteins and fats in your body to use as sugar in order to continue to function. Okay, so that one I just had to bite in the butt real quick because I'm like, I've heard this so many times and it is, I know we've talked about how frustrating it is when people will take this massively complex disease, like cancer, diabetes, anything, and they'll be like, oh, it's this simple. You just stop eating sugar. It's like, oh, that's okay. What is that telling the tens of thousands of researchers who have dedicated their entire lives to try and find a solution to this problem? And look at you sitting on the couch. You just figured it out. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Not that simple.
And again, people will take this, not probably not most of our audience for sure, but a lot of people would take this and say, like, this is us promoting eating sugar because people want to choose their own narrative. And those people refuse to accept that, of course, a diet that is really high in ultra processed foods, a lot of which are going to be high in sugar, but also high in saturated fats and also low in foods that are nutrient rich, good for you. Of course, that's going to be bad for your health. Not single components of foods. It is so much bigger than that. You have to look at the bigger picture. Nobody is just eating sugar or just not eating sugar. It's actually so fucking difficult to completely remove sugar from your diet. Keto diet gets pretty close, but the majority of people on keto are actually not in ketogenesis because of how hard it is to eliminate sugar.
It's in everything.
It is so difficult.
The actual sugar is in, that's what cracked me up on our keto episode, is when it's like 80%+ of people who are doing the keto diet are not even in ketosis because it's that hard to completely eliminate that from your diet. Mm-hmm. It's in normal food. So exactly to your point, to leave it out there, we're not saying to only eat sugar. We're not saying to shove as much sugar in your face as humanly possible. We're just saying not to be necessarily afraid of it. Be worried about the big rocks that we've always talked about, your daily movement, controlling your calorie intake, hitting your protein, resistance training. I get so many messages that are, if I get more than 15 grams of sugar in a day, is that too much? Is it going to cause a problem? That's the last thing that matters. Tell me about your protein. Tell me about your calories. Tell me about your daily activity. Those things will influence. It doesn't matter if you're getting 20 or 30 or 40 grams. You're going to have a hard time hitting your daily calorie intake and protein intake if your diet is majority sugar. That's the hard part. You're going to have a hard time checking off all those big boxes if your diet is made up of all sugar. So that's what we're saying. Don't be afraid of it, but we're not saying eat only sugar.
With questions like that, I almost want to be like, dude, I'm so sorry that you thought you had to put the time and energy into looking at that and thinking that's like, I'm so sorry that here, let me make it easier. Yeah. Like literally.
Seriously. It almost makes me stressed out when thinking about it. What happens when you get stressed?
Cortisol. Cortisol is such a buzz fucking word. It pisses me off. I especially see you just like, it's like the wellness girlies talking about balancing their hormones, lowering their cortisol lowering workouts or cortisol lowering foods, or I stopped weightlifting and did Pilates and my cortisol lowered and I lost all this fat. Influencers position lowering cortisol as like this magical mystery key to nearly every ailment of life, like poor sleep, weight gain, acne, like mood disorders. Like it's crazy. It's like, really? Do you think
if we could just get rid of it, all of our problems would be solved. Our bodies don't even need it.
Yeah. So let's, again, like going back to what Tony is saying, we have to understand these pieces in terms of how they play a role in the body. What is cortisol? What does it do in the body? Where are people even getting this from? It is so misunderstood. But most people know that cortisol is known as the stress hormone. Mm-hmm. It helps regulate your body's response to stress. That's where people are most familiar with it. When the brain perceives a threat, your body will respond by releasing cortisol from your adrenal glands. And this also has other big stream of effects. So its job is so much bigger than just stress and controlling our stress response. Like that is one piece of the puzzle, but cortisol also helps control how the body uses fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. It also helps regulate blood sugar and blood pressure, and it manages the sleep-wake cycle. It can also suppress and play a role in inflammation in the body. It affects nearly every organ system in the body.
That's my favorite part. It can actually reduce inflammation in certain settings. People always say it causes inflammation. It can actually reduce it in certain settings too.
Yeah.
That always makes me laugh.
It is crazy. And I also feel like One of its biggest and often overlooked pieces is the role in how it helps the body go to sleep and wake up. It's a critical component of our circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. So at night, cortisol levels will naturally drop, and as the body prepares for rest. And then in the morning, cortisol levels will begin to rise, preparing your body to wake up, which I just think is fascinating. And that's a big role it plays. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will talk about cortisol in the context of sleep, but they'll be very certain that if you lower cortisol, your sleep will improve.
Yeah.
But it's almost like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, poor sleep habits, like if you're doom scrolling before bed, or if you're eating like a ton of a huge, huge meal right before bed. I don't know. If you just exercised right before bed, that can all lead to poor sleep and can increase cortisol.
Yeah.
But high cortisol can also disrupt sleep. It's so much more complex.
It's not just a good or bad thing, it sounds like. Because even in the sleep episode on how to fix your sleep that we did a while back, we talked about how important it's one of the bigger pieces of that morning circadian rhythm, right? Where it spikes in the morning to wake you up. And what most people don't even think about when they're trying to improve their sleep is they're only looking at what can they do right before bed to essentially knock them out. What supplements can I take? What can I do to knock me out because I'm not tired when I go to bed? Not realizing that that essentially timer starts when you wake up in the morning. That cascade of events through the day to make you tired to fall asleep at night starts when your alarm goes off or starts when you wake up. So if that initial alarm clock in your body, cortisol, is not there, guess what's also going to be thrown off down the road when it's time to fall asleep? So many other things. People forget about
it. Yeah. Yeah. So, and there's this, it's also important to understand, I think most people do understand acute versus chronic stress. So it's important to have a certain level of cortisol production and a certain level of acute stress in your life. It's like a temporary threat that your body will perceive. Once that threat has passed, your body will typically stop releasing cortisol to allow it to resume its regular functions. But when that's like a protective mechanism. That's really important. We want to make sure that that's happening. Like, cortisol is not just the enemy. Like, it's very, very important. Mm. And it's also important for managing that stress response. And there's a wide fucking range of what is considered normal cortisol levels for adults. This pisses me off. Like, most cortisol, at-home cortisol tests, like, they're not going to be the most accurate at all. And they're based off of a generalized range of what is normal cortisol. Where from person to person, like, this could absolutely change, like, what's considered normal. So there's no one test that can determine whether you're above baseline unless you've been monitoring it with a physician for a prolonged period of time, like, not just once or twice. So I
was even going to say, with the at-home test, it's like your cortisol is a hormone that fluctuates so much in a single day.
So much.
Like, up and down in a day. So if you're doing an at-home test, the time of day that you're doing it, you could do it now and 4 hours from now and get two completely different readings, like one good, one quote unquote bad, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so here's where we start to get into this line of where people can really misinterpret how cortisol, just cortisol in general, and how it relates to your health and make some a lot of bold claims. But if the body has to respond to constant stress regularly over time, your cortisol levels will continuously rise and you'll get to this point of chronic stress where you have chronically elevated cortisol levels. Mm. They're not coming down to normal range. And this can absolutely cause this ripple effect of health problems. It can put individuals at a higher risk of anxiety and depression. It can influence digestive problems, headaches. It can make your sleep poor. It can influence weight gain, problems with memory and focus. It is so true that chronically elevated cortisol is associated, doesn't cause, it's associated with this broad set of symptoms. Mm. It is so ambiguous, though, in terms of pinpointing, did cortisol actually cause this? Because these issues are, like we're talking about, digestive issues, weight gain, if you're having sleep trouble, acne, are also influenced by a variety of other lifestyle, dietary, exercise habits. Cortisol, high cortisol, and your stress is a small piece of the puzzle. Important, but a small piece of the puzzle. And social media has oversimplified the solution to lowering cortisol and really doesn't take into account its complexity and the complexity of these issues in terms of it not just being as easy as, oh, well, your cortisol is too high. You just have to lower it.
I was going to say, I feel like a lot of people would just say, oh, you're experiencing one of these eight things. Lower your cortisol. You'll take care of
yeah.
it. You're stressed. Yeah. Oh, it's your cortisol. You gain weight. Oh, yeah. It's your cortisol.
Like you can have high cortisol from so many different stressors in your life. And there are things you could do to reduce your stress and reduce your cortisol. This is different from having an underlying disease that can also cause high cortisol. Like people don't like to take that into account. There are a lot of medical conditions that can lead to high levels of cortisol. And this will typically look at the production of tumors in your adrenal and pituitary gland. And these medical conditions like Cushing's disease are very dangerous. So there is a medical implication here of high cortisol, which if you oversimplify this, it can be very dangerous for someone and they may think, oh, you know, I'm fine. I don't even need to go to a doctor. There's two ends of the spectrum where it's like, it's not that deep. Yes, stress management is really important, but also look at some of the other factors of your life versus someone who has Cushing's disease or signs of Cushing's disease, which is tumor growth in your, I think it's your adrenal gland, adrenal or pituitary. But if you have signs of that, which could be like weight gain, specifically in your abdominal and face area, really struggling with sleep, acne, certain things like that, you might just dismiss it and not even think to go get it looked at. And I actually think that this is a problem with a lot of the generalization in social media with certain topics. It can kind of lean both ways. Like it almost makes me nervous if someone, I don't know, just brushing it off as, oh, I just need to go for a walk in the morning now. And I just need to do Pilates instead of weightlift. Like it's two ends of the spectrum that are important to consider. But that's not meant to like scare anyone. But I think it's just, I don't know. It's something I noticed.
Well, even like another one, the one that I keep hearing is that you shouldn't have coffee when you first wake up because it's going to spike your cortisol. And that, even though I think Menno Hanselman just did a great review of all data on that, completely just showing that that's nonsense. Like complete nonsense. That was another one. Drink coffee in the morning. It's going to spike your cortisol. That's why you're not losing weight.
Yeah. So the weight piece, right? But before I get into that, if you're just more stressed out than normal, or like you're experiencing normal stressors in life, those are going to account for just temporary fluctuations in cortisol levels. That's normal. And sometimes you're just going to have to adjust your lifestyle to make more time to have these stress relieving practices or prioritizing sleep or getting regular exercise, doing more things you enjoy. Like that's just life. Like as an adult, being cognizant of your stress and taking it into account and making sure you're tackling it, like that should just be a priority.
And even too, just a normal part of like stress itself isn't something you should always try to avoid. Like your body's response to stress and cortisol, like the production of it in the whole place, it plays a massive role in helping your body adapt to new challenges and new changes. So if your whole goal is just to avoid stress in life, it's like you're going to live a very comfortable life, which we know is not going to be good. Comfortable as in you're going to be seeking comfort. That's, you're never going to be growing, changing, improving. You're going to stay exactly where you are. And I think that's something to be said too about even just stress as a whole, is it can be good and bad, but the goal should not be to avoid it.
Completely demonizing cortisol when it's important in the body. I said that cortisol is associated with a lot of the high cortisol can be associated with a lot of these symptoms, these common symptoms that people talk about, especially weight gain. But high cortisol does not cause weight gain per se. Mm-hmm. Your body size fluctuates your body weight for so many different reasons.
Yeah.
Whether there's a connection between weight and cortisol, it can it's hard to pinpoint. It depends on where the weight gain is happening, but also that's typically a sign of an underlying disease. So where people put on fat, one possible reason may be due to high cortisol, but there are so many other different possible reasons as to why you're putting on fat.
And probably more likely, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so like high cortisol levels can possibly lead to weight gain in your abdomen and face. So like that's what doctors will look for if they're looking for certain diseases that chronically elevated cortisol is prevalent in. But for the majority of people, more often than not, cortisol is not going to be the cause of your weight gain. Stress may be a reason, a high stress lifestyle maybe the reason why you're engaging in habits that are promoting weight gain, but isn't it indirect association. That is what people, it's almost like the connection just breaks. They're like, oh, like high cortisol and fat, like I'm really stressed out. And now that I'm not stressed anymore, like I lowered my cortisol and I lost weight. It's like,
that is hilarious. Well, I haven't there? Even, honestly, this is embarrassing to almost say, I haven't even thought about that part yet. But what is the lifestyle that's going to lead to chronically elevated cortisol? You sleep crap every night. You're super high stress at your job. You're on too many stimulants. You're doing all these things. That would increase your cortisol. Just decreasing your cortisol is not going to help. Getting rid of all of those bad habits that led to the high cortisol. That's probably what caused any weight gain in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just still just one piece of the puzzle. This like connection to cortisol and weight gain has always blown my mind. There's actually this dieting itself could actually lead to higher production of cortisol due to being in a calorie deficit. So being in a calorie deficit
makes
can
sense.
Lead to higher cortisol. And that's a good thing. That's a good sign because weight loss improves all blood biomarkers across the board. So that could be a good thing. There's a study done in the Psychomatic Medicine Journal of Biobehavioral Medicine. And they created four groups, one that restricted calories and tracked what they ate each day, one that ate a calorie-restricted diet without tracking, one that tracked what they ate without counting calories, and a control group that ate normally with no tracking. And both groups that restricted calories saw an increase in cortisol, and those that tracked calories experienced an increase in perceived stress. So it was just a little bit more stressful experience because of the way that they were doing it. It doesn't matter. Like calorie restriction increases cortisol. That's it's what it's going to do. So we're already we're talking about how you're overweight because of high cortisol, but in the body, when you are in a calorie deficit, cortisol increases for every single person. So how does that make sense? Because when you're in a deficit, you're losing weight and increase in cortisol. Can we just, I don't know.
it's funny because when you lay it out on all the, like with a lot of these things, when you just think about it, even logically for the first second, when you hear about these mechanisms, okay, then just for a reference, like these are the mechanisms that we're talking about at the very beginning, how increased cortisol can lead to X, Y, or Z. But then you're assuming that that all leads to weight gain, that you're assuming that that all goes to X, Y, and Z. So people will have themselves convinced this is the issue. And it's funny because I think when we just lay it out all on the table, it's like, okay, we solving for the cause of the problem, or we're trying to treat the problem itself, right? Are we putting a Band-Aid on it, or are we trying to figure out where the heck it's coming from? All of these things that increase your cortisol and would lead to chronically elevated cortisol, those are probably the issues that you're facing of why you might not, because you might not be able to lose weight because of these factors. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But is it because your cortisol is high, or is it because of all of those nasty habits that have led to that?
Yep. Yeah.
But it's easy to get down that rabbit hole and be convinced of like, holy crap, this is cortisol. It's ruining
me. Yeah. Yeah. Also, what you'll see a lot is how like the relationship between cortisol and exercise and workouts that lower cortisol or increase cortisol. You'll see so many like wellness people and influencers telling you to avoid high impact exercise or HIIT training or weightlifting because they increase cortisol. In theory, like this is correct. Intense exercise damages our muscles in the process of regrowth and making them stronger. That all those processes raise our cortisol levels. I want to especially talk about in the context of weightlifting and muscle growth. That process is going to increase your cortisol. That's a really good thing. Putting on muscle is a really, really good, really good thing. So that's the craziest thing to me. And where people can misinterpret this again is that overtraining also is going to elevate cortisol. That's where you may have some health implications, of course, if you're not prioritizing rest and recovery.
That can lead to chronically elevated cortisol, not the temporary spikes that you might see from just weight training once in a while.
Yeah. So, and to the solution to that is not to focus on all of the shit you're going to do to lower your cortisol. It's just to focus on adding rest into your program and making sure you're recovering properly. It's not, okay, well, I need to lower my cortisol levels. Which foods can lower my cortisol? Which exercises? I need to stop weightlifting. No, you're just overtraining. Like, so, yeah.
So it sounds like, end of the day, it sounds like for cortisol, it's like, no one's arguing, we're not arguing that chronically elevated cortisol can't lead to a host of problems.
Yeah, so that's not a good thing. You don't want that.
Yeah, that will lead to problems. That's not what we're saying. We're not saying all cortisol all the time. We're just saying that it's a great thing, nay, a necessity, right? Your body probably wouldn't have found a gland to produce it if it didn't need it. A necessity that you need to keep moving forward. That's the distinction we're trying to make, it seems like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. I feel like I don't even need to go any further than that. I think that's good.
Yeah, which goes into all that, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Should we talk about the behemoth?
Yeah. Strategically made it so I didn't take this one on because we'd probably have so much anger and cussing. Not that we already like.
You're doing pretty good today. Seed oils. They're having a moment.
They've been having a moment.
Yes. It's been a good while now. And these claims around seed oil are pretty scary, to be honest. They're pretty scary when you look at them. How they increase your inflammation, how they lead to heart disease, how they damage your metabolic health, how they can even lead to cancer. A lot of these things people are linking to seed oils. A lot of even health professionals, quote unquote, are linking these to seed oils. I just want to start by saying, like, okay, first of all, what are seed oils? What are they? Because one thing I notice is seed oils, pretty much just for reference, they're oils that come from seeds. Okay, so this is canola oil, sunflower oil, sesame oil, safflower oil, pumpkin seed oil, flaxseed oil. There's at least 30 to 50 different kinds of seed oils. Okay, seed oils isn't just one thing.
That's not even accounting for people will clump, like, they'll be say seed oils, but they'll clump in vegetable oils too. Like, it's like seed and vegetable oils. So then you get so many more. Like,
yeah. And that's not a good or bad thing on its own. There's 30 to 50 different kinds of seed oils on their own. But it is a little bit of a red flag initially when you hear claims against seed oils, period. Because whenever you hear someone lumping so many different things under one category and then labeling that category as bad, I don't think you should deem it not legitimate, but you should be highly suspicious, right? Imagine if someone said, red cars are bad because I have a red car once, I had a red car once, and it broke down all the time. Therefore, every red car is bad. That sounds stupid. That sounds like almost jokingly stupid. Or movies are bad, not taking into account the genre, the cast, the anything, because you saw one bad movie. Okay. But people do this when it comes to health and nutrition, and no one bats an eye. They just lump so many different things into one category. Same thing with sugars. There's a lot of different sugars, but people just put them into one and say sugar is bad. Sugar spikes insulin. Some of them do. A lot of them don't. Same thing here, though. And this is at least something I almost never see, is a negative claim about a particular seed oil, like singling one out and then telling you why that one is bad at what dose. Because we can't have that conversation either. The dose is in the poison. If something bad, okay, how much of it's bad? How much of it's bad? It's always just seed oils are bad for X reason. Okay, seed oils, all seed oils, at all doses, they're all bad. We should avoid them. Okay, now these are all very different compounds. They have very different actions in the body, and they're metabolized even in different ways. And a lot of this seed oil campaign, maybe you have more insight on this. I've noticed at least more brought up by the low-carb carnivore groups of people. For the most part. And that's at least who I see as like front running all these negative claims about that.
I see that. And honestly, I just see like the health wellness like space in
general. Kind of now attaching onto it.
And also like just anyone in a grocery store that's going to tell you what not to eat. For some reason, they just fucking hate seed oils. They've all banded together. And
okay, that is actually true.
Screaming at a fucking box of Cheerios, getting red in the face because Cheerios and the seed oils in it are giving you cancer and causing inflammation.
Like, that would be a fun
I don't know,
stat.
Whatever you want to. It's our grocery. What do I call them?
Goblins?
Grocery store goblins?
Grocery store goblins? No, like, yeah, every shirtless person in a grocery store telling you what foods to not eat at the grocery store. They're probably telling you're right. That would be a hilarious stat to look at. What percent of them are saying don't eat this because of seed oils? But again, and I think this is really important to look at the other side's argument, because just like, again, how people are afraid of dogs for certain reasons, these people have their reasons too. They're not just making things up out of thin air, even though it might seem like that sometimes. Now, when you look at the arguments against seed oils,
I beg to differ, Tony, because some people don't even give you, they will just say that. They'll just say that they're toxic without any.
But do you truly believe they just woke up and for some reason, no one told them that seed oils are bad. No one gave them a reason. They just said,
No. I don't believe that. But
that's what I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
Sound like their reasoning is so sound and they really do know.
No. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they have a reason. Okay. It might not be a good reason, but they have a reason. Everyone's got a reason for what they do.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a reason for what they do. And I think if you want to make any progress, you have to understand the other side's reason, right? You have
to. For sure.
And when you look at arguments against seed oils, one, they're mostly talking about omega-6s in terms of fatty acids like linoleic acid. Okay, that's a big group is omega-6s. Mm-hmm. And in epidemiology, which is just the study and analysis of the distribution of and patterns of health and disease conditions inside of a defined population, the consumption, this is true, the consumption of high amounts of these oils are associated with quite a few negative health effects. We can see these negative effects on a cellular level too when we test them in petri dishes. And we can see them when we test them on animals when we give them high doses. Okay. A lot of people will see this and they'll just lump seed oils together. They say, oh, see, seed oils, they're very toxic. We can see this in animals. We can see this in a petri dish. Or we can see this when we look at epidemiology. But there's one problem, I think, and we'd love to hear your take on basing claims off of just those few things, is one, epidemiology, it's a lot of correlation, meaning it's a lot of patterns. It's not always translational. It's not exact. It's mm-hmm. not causation. And a lot of the times, especially in this case, it doesn't translate to humans. But it's still a scary thing. It's like, oh, well, you notice all these negative health effects when you look at this broader population, you see these negative health effects from people who are eating more seed oils. I think it's not even illogical to be like, oh, well, are those seed oils causing those negative health effects? If you're seeing more in people who consume more seed oils, it's like an understandable place to base your judgment off of, right?
Yeah. But with nutritional epidemiology, oh my God, I'm having PTSD because I did not like that class, but you actually cannot infer causation for anything with that type of research. Because you are analyzing patterns in really large scale populations where epidemiology is really helpful is to look at disease states of populations, just overall health. So, okay, what percent of the population in this area has diabetes? What percent of the population in this area is on supplemental nutrition assistance programs? Things like that. So you can study the health and behaviors of large groups. And then when you look at that in connection, so say, you're looking at a group of people, you're in this town, and a majority of the town is getting nutrition assistance. So it's going to be more low income. And you also see, okay, well, a majority of this town is not meeting their fruit and vegetable consumption either. And most of these people spend their SNAP benefits on ultra processed foods, not whole foods. Okay, that now we can look at these behaviors and we could see, okay, there is a connection between this large group of people eating a diet that is high in processed foods and low in foods that are good for you. And we also see a lot of, I don't know, people that have diabetes. Okay, maybe we're trying to make that connection here. We're just making the connection. We notice this, but it doesn't mean it causes this disease. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it causes this population to say be overweight or obese, but there's something we could do about that. We can make fruit and vegetables more accessible in this large town. I don't know. Sorry, that may seem, but that might sound boring and that may seem like a large tangent, but that's what it is. It's just looking at behaviors and looking at health data and health metrics of large populations and trying to understand, okay, from a nutritional standpoint, how can we improve this on a large scale?
Exactly. It's a valid red flag that should say, oh, maybe we should look into this a little bit more, right? Hmm. Maybe we should. We're seeing this in animal studies, in vitro or in like a petri dish. We're seeing this in epidemiology. We should look a little bit deeper. But a fun stat I like to tell people, this is the same. It's you almost have to get ridiculous when drawing this parallel, is you'll notice if you look at shark attacks, rates of shark attacks, and the rates of ice cream sales, you notice that they both increase at nearly identical times of the year. It's in the summertime. I don't immediately then think that ice cream sales jump up, ice cream causes shark attacks. I don't think that. Okay. Maybe it's something that's not being measured in those two. That's where the logical brain goes, right? Maybe it's something outside of just ice cream or shark attacks. Those are cool trends, but maybe there's something else that we're not measuring right now. Mm-hmm. Like how when the temperature goes up in the summertime, more people go to the beach, leading to more shark attacks. More people want to cool off, so they want ice cream. Okay, that's a good example of correlation and why you can't always just compare those two lines and say, see, this is what caused this. And, yeah. And again, if you go to school and you study this and you know this, it's almost common sense at that point. But to most people, it's easy to draw those two parallels. So if you really want to see, and this is what we want to do, right? We want to see then, okay, there's a lot of red flags around seed oils. Let's see if seed oils are uniquely harmful. What we have to do then is we have to separate them and say, okay, let's look at what happens when we take, for example, saturated fat in people's diets and we substitute it with polyunsaturated fats or omega-6s in a 1-to-1 ratio. Let's replace the fats that you're having right now in your diet and let's fill them with these seed oils and see if we notice those increases in these negative health outcomes, right? That's what we need to do to see if they're uniquely harmful. Mm-hmm. Now, good news is researchers have done this quite a bit now in humans, quite a bit now. And I want to look at each claim individually because I think that's important. We can't just say good, bad, whatever. But I want to look at first what happens to inflammation when we do this, when we replace, let's say, saturated fats with omega-6s or with polyunsaturated fats.
So, and for people who don't know, a saturated fat would say, for an example, say we're replacing butter, solid butter, with any sort of seed oil, essentially. Like it could be, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that's it's a good, because people are like, wait, saturated, what is that? Like the most common fat probably in most people's diets. Yeah. Okay. Because a lot of people, I know this is an argument I've heard from seed oil sides, is like, oh, these seed oils, they have these double bonds and they can get oxidized and that causes a bunch of inflammation. And all that inflammation can lead to other diseases like heart disease down the road. So inflammation's bad for whatever reasons, right? So, okay, what happens when we replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fats in a 1-to-1 ratio? What happens to inflammation? Based on all of the human trials done, that we will cite below in the show notes for this. I want everyone to know that too. We will cite all of these below. There's either a neutral or a positive effect on inflammation markers in the body. Neutral or positive. So things didn't get worse. Inflammation did not get worse. It either stayed the same or got better when you replace these oils with what normally would be constituted as fats in most people's diets. Okay. Inflammation, that's a little odd. Got better, not worse. What happens when we look at heart disease? We see kind of a similar trend. People who replace saturated fats with polyunsaturated fats either have similar or lower risk of heart disease when you look at human randomized control trials. I'm going to keep saying the human part because that's very important, and we'll talk about that in a sec. And even when you look at larger prospective cohort studies, it's actually a much higher effect because these studies are longer. And the people who replace saturated fats with these polyunsaturated fats see a significant reduction in the risk of heart disease. Not an increase, which should happen if these seed oils cause inflammation, if they lead to heart disease. If you add seed oils into your diet, then you should see increased rates of those, not decreased. Okay. What about metabolic health? That's important. Same thing. When you replace saturated fats with polyunsaturated fats from seed oils, you see improvements in insulin sensitivity, a reduction in HbA1c, a reduction in fasting blood glucose, a reduction in C-peptide, which is a marker for insulin secretion, more commonly known for inflammation, and also a massive reduction in LDL cholesterol. Most people call that the bad cholesterol because it has more close ties to heart disease. So metabolically, you actually see mostly health improvements when you replace saturated fats with these polyunsaturated fats, these omega-6s, these seed oils. And cancer, for the last piece on here, is the other claim I hear all the time. All human trials so far have seen pretty much no difference, right? So no improvements, no harm, neither an increase or decrease risk of any cancer when people substitute with seed oils. Okay. And I want to highlight, like, this is the difference between testing something in a petri dish or on rats in a cage and testing something on humans in real life with thousands of different influences. This is the difference, right? Like when you test, for example, artificial sweeteners from Diet Coke on gut bacteria. When you put that gut bacteria in a petri dish outside of a human body, and you megadose them, bad things happen. But when you do that to them inside of a human body, where there's thousands of other things that are influencing what's happening with that bacteria, nothing happens, because life or health does not exist in a vacuum. And people forget that. They'll see these things in a petri dish or in a rat or somewhere else and say, that is bad. And again, I'm not saying these can't be red flags. If you notice these things in rodents, in petri dishes, that's not the point of those types of research. That's to say, hey, maybe we should look into trials in humans. Maybe we should look at investing in this stuff. Like Lane Norton had a really good analogy for this. It's like when someone looks at a mutual fund with 50 different stocks, let's say, and they'll point at one of the stocks that's down 40%. And they'll be like, that mutual fund sucks because that stock right there, that went down 40%. But then when you look at the entire mutual fund, it's up 20% altogether, right? The collective 50 stocks are up by 20%. This is the argument of just pointing out one of those stocks and saying you should avoid that entire fund because of that one stock that did bad. It's like health is so complicated and so complex. That's what I think the biggest difference is.
You know what is so funny to me too? Like, realistically, for people who are like, so like, say you have seed oils in your diet or you're worried about them, look at them in the context of your diet. How much do they constitute your diet? It's oil. If it is that prevalent and you're like, are you dousing everything in oil? Are you drinking it? Like, it's such a small piece. And even in processed foods, it's typically at the bottom of the ingredients list. Like, it's not a big, it doesn't make up a large component.
Yeah.
So it's just like, look at the context of your diet. I say this all the time. I feel like a broken record as a whole. And people will all the time just make this assumption that it's the seed oils problem. And it's not the fact that ultra processed seed oils are found in ultra processed foods. If people are mainly eating ultra processed foods and not whole foods, okay, as a whole, there's going to be a lot of reasons why that's going to impact our health.
Yeah.
They're high in seed oils, but that has.
But that's, you're not just chugging the seed oil. There's other things in there.
Seed oil.
Exactly. Like, because people will still say that. They're like, well, how has America gone from being so lean and healthy in the 70s to obese now? And at the same exact time, we see this increase in seed oil starting to appear in almost every food we eat. And it's like, okay, do we even want to consider that maybe the average daily calorie intake is up by almost 1,000 calories per day since then? No, let's not talk about the calories.
Are we going to talk about the Industrial Revolution? And are we going to talk about how everyone's enslaved to a 9-to-5 fucking job and how we're just feeding big businesses and people don't have time to prioritize their health or the money? No, let's not fucking talk about that.
Like, it's getting a little conspiracy.
Sorry.
But no, like a big, like that's a big thing. We're averaging 1,000 more calories than usual. Is that because of seed oils? No, no logical person will tell you that. Okay. For example, I think the reason where all this comes from and where people are like, well, but wait, why do you see an increased rate of disease in the populations that also consume more seed oils? A very common place that you find a lot of seed oils is in fried foods, in fast foods, in highly processed foods like you're talking about. So if your diet is constituted of fast food, highly processed food, and you see negative health outcomes, how the hell are you going to say, it's the seed oil? It's not the fact that you're eating like thousands of extra calories and all of this saturated fat and all of this extra everything. It's that one little thing that they cooked it in.
You know, like, where I really drew the line, where I really just got so angry about this whole entire thing. And it blew my top off. I saw a TikTok of this lady. She was holding up a Costco rotisserie chicken. And she said,
don't touch my rotisserie chicken.
She goes, this is toxic. Look at the seed oils in this rotisserie chicken. This is not what you want to be putting in your body. I lost my shit. I was like, you're coming for the rotisserie chicken? My beef just escalated tenfold. Like, there is no way this is happening. They're coming for rotisserie chickens? Go throw rocks at your forehead.
Do it. But that's so at the end of the day, like, people are still, like, they're still confused on that part. It's like, if your diet is high in seed oils, it's probably also just a shitty diet as a whole. Okay? That you have to consider that. If your diet is high in seed oils, I doubt that it's because you're hitting enough protein. I doubt that you're hitting enough fiber. I doubt that it's at a moderate amount of calories. It's every aspect of a crappy diet as a whole, if it's also high in seed oils. It's not the seed oils per se.
You know what I was just thinking about, like, too, which this is just, you know, a think tank in my head. People with oil, like, in general, people don't really consider how calorie dense oil is.
Yeah.
And that it can changing, like, reducing the oil you use to cook foods with. And typically, I don't know, like, why Americans do this, but they think they need to put oil on everything. Like, it's weird, but just reducing that, or even switching out like oil with like a spray oil instead, you can significantly cut your calories and you can lose, like, that may be the key to being eating in a calorie deficit. No joke, because 2 tablespoons of oil is like 120 calories. And you think you're using 2 tablespoons, but you're using like a fourth cup. And
that's actually 1 tablespoon is usually one tablespoon. Of, like, I know that's where it's usually 1 tablespoon is 90 to 120 calories of most oils.
Yeah. But no one wants to talk about that. Like, maybe that's just the reason why you're overeating, over consuming.
Yeah. So, like, to leave it there, because we don't want it to drag it out too much longer, because I think we've made
our point.
Our points there is, like, until there's translational data on something, you cannot say it causes any negative health outcome. You can't. And that is the reason why. No matter how many mechanisms you want to argue with, if every single time you are looking for a certain metric to decrease, if every single time you test that in humans, it does the opposite, you're missing part of the puzzle. You're missing part of the picture. And that's just where it is. And people are ignoring just the complexity of sesame oil. Show me one study that shows any negative effect with sesame oil or nuts. That's a seed oil too.
It honestly should be a relief. Like, it should be a relief that it's like, oh. You do not have to, you actually don't have to worry about these at all. Like,
no,
not at all.
No. So that's where we'll wrap it up is, like, with that piece of it is, should you worry about it? Should you pay? No, you shouldn't. You should be focused on, again, the big boxes. Where's your total calorie intake? Are you getting enough protein? Are you getting enough fiber? Because if you're doing all of those things, I doubt you could find a possible way to also have a diet that's overtaken in seed oils.
Yeah.
That's the point. That's the point. So let's wrap that there because we still got two more left. We still got two more left today.
That's
a seed oil topic. We'll put all the research down below. Number four.
We got the ones where that are like more heated, I would say, out of the way.
Yeah.
Save the quicker ones, I'd say, for the end.
Yeah.
But okay, so this concept of fat burning. It's been around all the time. It's such a buzzword. Burning fat burning, foods that burn fat, exercises. Hear it all the time. What is fat burning? Again, like, ask the person who is saying that this is going to burn fat and make you lose all this weight, or a 12-3-30.
Yeah, this increases or decreases fat burning. What does that mean?
Yeah. Just ask them to explain
it. What do you mean by that?
I'm going to explain it for you guys. And this is one that, for some reason, it's always gotten under my gears ever since, like, just from learning it and about it so many times in school. It makes me want to, like, hit my head against a wall when people misinterpret this. But fat burning is, like, the lay term, or the just, like, more common term that people use for fat oxidation. So this is the use of fat as a fuel source by the body. So fat oxidation, fat burning, like, used interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But fat is stored in our bodies in the form of triglycerides. So triglycerides are found in the bloodstream, adipose tissue, your fat cells, and to a lesser extent within muscle. And to be used as fuel, triglycerides need to be broken down into fatty acids. And this is a process called lipolysis. So your body will prioritize using triglycerides in the bloodstream and muscle first. And once these supplies run low, the triglycerides will be mobilized from the fat cells. So they'll go to your fat cells as a last resort. This is where the idea that fat burning equals fat loss comes in. So this
is that where we're going to say is where most of the misunderstanding comes from, is that people are using these, losing fat and burning fat are the same thing. And we're saying they're not.
Yes. Right? Oh, that's sorry. I didn't say that at the beginning. Yeah, that's the misconception.
Because I was going to say, I think a lot of people are confused. Wait, what do you mean? Like, fat burning is a misunderstanding. I think people are misunderstanding, right?
I got too excited.
Saying that burning fat is the same thing as losing fat. People use those words interchangeably, but they're not the same thing.
And that's not the case. Yeah. Okay. Just because you are burning fat does not equal fat loss. I should have started with that. Sorry, guys. I got too excited. Okay.
No, but it all makes sense. I was like, just putting those together. That makes total sense, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So, where was I? Okay. So this idea that once your supplies of triglycerides in the blood and muscle run low, you're going to be mobilizing your fat cells, your triglycerides from your fat cells. And that's where people will misinterpret, you know, oh, okay. So you're utilizing this fat from your fat cells for fuel. So that must mean that you're also losing that fat because it's coming from your fat cells.
Yeah.
Your body is quite literally taking fat out of your fat cells to produce energy. But if you are not in a calorie deficit, fat burning cannot by any means result in fat loss. It is physiologically impossible. This is because, and you guys are going to have to stick with me on this, I'm going to get a little sciencey. Energy doesn't just simply disappear. So the idea that fat is converted to energy that is released as heat, can be released as heat, violates the law of conservation of mass, which states that mass, like energy, is neither created nor destroyed. So the body does use energy from calories that are burned through physical activity or metabolism that will power certain functions like maintaining your body temperature, fueling muscle contractions, a lot of other processes. The energy from the calories burned is transformed and utilized within the body. It is not being created or destroyed.
Transformed.
It doesn't just disappear. You can't just get rid of energy. So when fat cells release lipids, or if people want to understand, release the fat, essentially, they are used to create energy in the body. Fat is a storage form of energy. And calories are just the unit in which you measure that energy. But we are utilizing that energy in some way, shape, or form. We're not releasing it. We're not just getting rid of energy. And again, so like that process, if your body is burning off a lot of energy, that is what happens when you're in an energy deficit and you see weight loss. But just because you are releasing fat from fat cells to use as energy, you're using it other places. It is not being released as heat and burned off and accounting for.
Gotten rid of. Yeah.
Getting rid of that fat, essentially. For example, if you are eating 2,000 calories a day, and that's also how much energy your body burns in a day, your body can't just magically burn through its energy stores in fat because you are feeding it the adequate amount it requires to function. However, if you are in an energy, if you're in a calorie deficit, okay, that is when you are going to see, you're going to burn through more energy because that's the process of energy balance. So which I don't want to get too much into, but
it sounds like people are forgetting that there's not just fat burning happens, fat storage is also something that happens. And if you're taking in as much energy as you're burning, doesn't matter if you're burning X amount of fat here, you'll store it back because you're eating X amount of calories.
Yes.
That's what I think people don't, they forget the whole storage part.
Yes.
Because that's even like, I know we talk about with the whole fat, like the 12-3-30 workouts or the magic fat burning zone, which does technically exist where you're oxidizing more fat, exercising at certain efforts, but that doesn't just equate to fat. Like you just said, you could spend 24 hours a day in that quote unquote fat burning zone. If you're eating as many calories as you're burning, you will store just as much back. Your body has this 24-hour calibration system.
I think that the biggest issue is here is people treat fat burning, which is a process that happens in your body. Fat burning is a process. And they're treating that as the same as energy balance, being in negative or positive energy balance. They are separate things taking place. And so I just wanted to put an example into play that will help people understand this a little bit more, because people ask a lot about the keto diet. Well, the keto diet is the best for burning fat and it works
so
well.
You eat more fats, your body burns it for energy, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Your body will utilize what you are feeding it the most. So if you're feeding it mainly carbs, you're going to predominantly use carbs as a fuel source. If you're eating mainly fats, you're going to, and very, very little carbs. This is much harder to do as I just talked about, like on the keto diet, it will burn mostly fat as a fuel source.
Yeah.
Because that is what is most available in the bloodstream. There'll be a continuous source of triglycerides in the bloodstream to oxidize or burn, use for energy. but there will also be a higher rate of fat storage. So this is what Tony was just getting into. Although you'll be mobilizing fat from fat tissue, moving this fat out of fat tissue, your body is also storing it, the fat, at the same time. And so that's like an example of why the keto diet, it doesn't magically burn through all this fat, because you're eating more fat.
Yeah. It's that whole thing that we talked about at the beginning. It starts on a very factual mechanism in the body. If you eat a lot of fats in your diet, your body will factually burn more fat. But people start layering assumption on top of assumption. Oh, well, you're burning more fat. I'm assuming that means that you're losing more fat. I'm assuming that's going to lead to weight loss. Those are all assumptions that aren't true. They're starting at a very factual mechanism in the body, but that doesn't mean the assumptions are true from there.
Yeah. And what it sounds so like. Research has continuously showed that while low-carb diets do increase fat burning, fat oxidation, they don't result in more fat loss in comparison to high-carb diets when calories and protein are matched. We have talked about this many a time. And when studied, neither low-carb diets or low-fat diets, when combined with a calorie deficit, have been found to be significantly better than the other for fat loss in the long term. If you want to lose body fat, you have to eat fewer calories than you expend, independent of the fuels that you use. The proportion of fats to carbs in your diet is almost irrelevant. And some people may be able to maintain a calorie deficit better by eating higher carbs, while some may do better eating higher in fat. Doesn't matter. And that's where I feel like the application piece comes in, because people get so caught up in, oh, if I want to burn the most fat and lose the most fat, I have to eat higher fat. No. Those processes are completely separate.
Yeah.
Do
real
whatever
is going
to work best for you to maintain a calorie deficit. If you lean more towards higher carb foods and that's what you enjoy more, that makes it easier to be in a calorie deficit. Go for it. Versus if you do better eating higher fat foods and that's what your body craves, go for it. But regardless, this fat burning process does not at all mean that you're going to lose it.
It's real. Yeah. It just doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
And because that's not just in diets, but in supplements. Like, there are supplements, there are diets, there are specific kinds of workouts that all increase fat burning. That doesn't matter. That's why we're saying this is such a misunderstood topic. Those are all factual things. Diets, supplements, certain workouts can increase fat burning.
I'm burning more fat, right? Well, maybe I just got my heart rate.
Yeah, you were just going hype mode. Yeah. You listening to this right now, if you're walking on the treadmill, if you're sitting at home, if you're driving in the car, your body's primarily burning fat for fuel right now. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. If you go start lifting some weights, you're going to be burning actually much less fat. Does that mean we should avoid lifting weight? No. That's why it's misunderstood. Yeah. And I think that's an important one to lead into our final one of the day, right? Which is insulin, which I think is kind of piggybacked on this misunderstanding ride from sugar as well. Because at first it was sugar's the problem. People found out that high sugary foods can spike insulin. So insulin became the problem when people started to figure out more and more, oh, sugar's not really the problem. It's insulin. The more data comes out, and it's like, oh, well, that thing we thought was evil, it's not that evil. It's the next thing. It's the next thing. It's seed oils. It's sugar. It's whatever. But this one's actually kind of sketch. Like, insulin has one goal, and that's to make you fat in a type 2 diabetic. And that's a lie. Okay? Insulin has been taking a beating these past freaking few years. Okay? And because carbs and sugar have the largest impact at increasing insulin in the body, which is a hormone we'll talk about in a sec, they've kind of been hurt by secondary consequences. So, like, real quick, what is insulin? I've talked about this a lot when we've talked about CGM. For reference, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I've gotten pretty familiar with insulin over the past 10 years or so of my life, needing to inject it at every single meal and seeing an endocrinologist quarterly for a decade. I've gotten pretty familiar with it. Insulin is a hormone in the body. Hormones, and why they're different than like nutritional compounds, things like that. Hormones are little chemical messengers in the body that get produced by an organ or a gland in one part of our body, put into the bloodstream, where they travel to certain other tissues in the body that have little receptors to catch these. And they're like little messengers. This gland will produce it. It'll tell tissue in your body to do some action over here, right? It causes some certain reaction. And insulin's job is a very important one. When you eat food, it's broken down into basic nutrients. Like we talked about just how like sugar and carbs, they're all broken down into the same chemical piece, same basic nutrient. Protein breaks down into amino acids. Dietary fats get broken down into fatty acids. Carbohydrates get broken down into glucose. those all make its way into the bloodstream. These nutrients then need to be moved from the bloodstream into somewhere else, right? Into muscle, into fat, or stored for later use, okay? Or to be used as things go. And that's where insulin comes in, okay? It helps shuttle the nutrients into the cells by telling the cells to open up and absorb them. So think of insulin as the key in certain cells, like your muscle, your fat cells. They have locks on them, and insulin opens that, lets certain nutrients in, right? They'll let carbohydrates get stored into your muscle tissue. That's where most of your carbs are stored, in muscle tissue. So when you eat any food that contains amino acids, fatty acids, and or glucose, so not just carbs, your pancreas secretes insulin to let them into cells throughout your body. You're telling me not just sugar and carbs makes your body secrete insulin? What? They didn't tell me that when they told me to be afraid of it. Exactly. Okay. And honestly, when you explain it like that, you're like, well, wait a sec. Insulin kind of sounds not that bad. Like, it even sounds like something we would die without, because it is.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Because it is. You would die without insulin. You need it. But again, why has it been made out to be this monster? I think that's because of a couple reasons, but one is because one of the functions sounds kind of scary. And in all of that part of what I was explaining, how it benefits our body, in all of that, one thing it does is it tells your body to stop burning fat stores and instead start storing fat or fatty acids that are in the blood as fat in fat tissue. Okay, so it kind of flips the switch off from fat burning, flips it on for fat storage. So logic then tells us and most people, okay, well, if a higher carb diet releases more insulin, and more insulin means less fat burning and more fat storage, then high carb diets mean you get fatter and fatter, which honestly, that kind of makes sense, right? Like, if you're spending more time flipping those switches, you would think the less time you can spend doing that, the better. So if people think that, they think, you know, well, if insulin temporarily prevents my body from burning fat and it stores body fat, if I avoid insulin altogether, I'll just always be burning fat and I'll never store it, right? That's kind of the conversation we just had in this fat storage, fat burning conversation, okay? There's a big hole in this theory, and that is that insulin isn't the only substance that triggers fat storage. They didn't tell you that either. Oh my God, no. Your fat cells contain an enzyme called hormone-sensitive lipase, HS. This is what insulin suppresses, but something carb and insulin haters like to ignore is the fact that dietary fat, so not carbohydrates, not sugar, not glucose, dietary fat also suppresses HSL. And thanks to an enzyme, your body doesn't need high levels of insulin to store dietary fat as body fat either. You don't need mountains of insulin to do this. It's just one thing it also does. Okay? So even if you're getting a little bit less, that's all your body needs to store body fat. It's in that energy balance there. Okay. And this is what every single human trial ever done on weight gain and weight loss has shown, that calorie intake is responsible, like we've said a million times and we'll say a million more, for fat loss or weight loss. Not necessarily where those calories are coming from. If you're eating more calories you take in each day and you're avoiding foods that increase insulin at all, you will still gain fat. You will still gain fat. And your health markers will be negatively impacted because of that. Period. Now, the fact that so many other things influence your blood sugar, I think this is another piece of this, that aren't carbs and sugar. Like, people like look at your blood sugar and avoid these spikes. We talk about this all the time with CGMs. Carbs and sugar aren't the only thing that impact your insulin and your blood sugar. From a dietary standpoint, protein, dietary fats, alcohol, even just drinking caffeine with zero calories, that can all increase blood sugar, that can all increase insulin. From a biological standpoint, a bad night's sleep will influence that. Being stressed or anxious, being sick, being on your period. Even from an exercise point of view, lifting heavy weights, high intensity cardio, even just changing the time of day that you exercise will influence how your blood sugar and insulin responds. Okay, even stupid things like being in a really cold environment or having a sunburn, all of these things can influence this. And just like with sugar, when people have a moderately healthy lifestyle and you control the calories they eat while they're hitting their protein, their fat goals, research is clear that insulin levels don't increase the risk of any negative health outcomes, including type 2 diabetes, when everything else is under control. Okay? It just becomes another case of people wanting to blame everything possible but excessive calories and an inactive lifestyle as the issue. Okay, same conversation that's we'll end it here. It seems like a freaking theme of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
A lifestyle that promotes very high levels of insulin will also probably lead to weight gain, obesity, and type 2 diabetes, but it's not the insulin that's doing it. It's because that lifestyle is also probably extremely sedentary, contains no weightlifting, is overtaken by very high calorie, highly processed foods, some of them containing sugar. Those are the things that will lead to type 2 diabetes. Those are the things that will lead to obesity, weight gain, not just insulin. Okay? It plays a lot of other important roles in the body. It helps you build muscle. It shuttles nutrients into your muscle tissue during your workouts, suppresses your appetite hormones like hunger. It's a great thing in moderation. Like every other enemy that we've talked about today, insulin isn't the problem. Being sedentary, being overweight, that's the problem. Okay? So I think it's almost hilarious to me as we go through this episode, noticing how similar each one of these misunderstood topics is. It's a one small role in a bigger health problem that people want to focus on instead of focusing on the things that matter. Like all of these things are like, you know what? Like we can't blame excessive calorie intake. We can't blame an inactive lifestyle. We can't do those things, right? That would be stupid of us. We have to find something else. That, like that's what it all boils down to, is what it looks like with all five of these. Is it not?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Like all five of them. Well, we can't look at calories. It's not the calories. It can't
be. It's the same pattern. Yeah.
It's not the sedentary lifestyle. It's not the things that we know. No, that would be too easy. That wouldn't catch trends. That wouldn't scare people. That wouldn't get people to watch me shirtless in a grocery store. That wouldn't get, it's whatever. This episode, I think, was a lot deeper and longer than we thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it was.
But
I'm
honestly,
like, I'm not even going to add anything because I don't want to lose people. But I think that, yeah.
But I'm glad we did. I'm glad we did that episode because I think it needed to be done with all these. And I can't tell you how many people I'm going to send to this, especially for the seed oil conversation, but we'll put a bow on that for your Monday. All right. So everybody else in premium, we'll talk to you guys this Friday in our AMA. Everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday with a hot, fresh new episode. And if you want to join us over on premium, get access to all of our 12-week training programs. Sign up for that is in the show notes below, along with all research we referenced today in the show notes. Keep on down there, and we'll talk to you soon.